I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of September. Ellen Bravo has written an important and really highly interesting novel that takes on date rape and the silence that surrounds the crime, privilege, a U.S. Senate race, friendship, the press, and more. The book is Again and Again, and the chapters alternate between the late 70s at fictitious Danforth University, where Liddy, who is a student there, is the victim of a violent rape in her dorm room. Her roommate, Deborah, witnesses the attack. In 2010, Deborah is the head of an organization working on issues concerning violence against women. A Republican Senate candidate who has a favorable record on some issues of concern to that group is accused of a college rape, and it turns out to be the very rape that Deborah witnessed. Ellen is a Milwaukee resident. She is director of Family Values at Work Consortium, a network of broad coalitions working for paid sick days and family leave insurance, which is now in 21 states. She was with 9 to 5 for more than 20 years, national director until 2004. She appears frequently on TV and radio, and her writing is featured in the New York Times, The Nation, and many other publications. She's also author of Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. We cited the numbers here, but they're worth citing at the beginning of this hour, that almost one quarter of women will face the threat of or experience rape during their college years. It is a very important and large issue in this country. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. All of those methods of getting a hold of us are open to you during this hour. Ellen Bravo, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Ellen.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks
good.
So much.
Yeah, congratulations on the book. I did read it last night. I didn't think I was going to be able to get through all of it, but I did because it's really a good read in addition to being an important story with all the elements of an important issue and politics and marriage and children and everything. And congratulations on it.
Thanks so much. I keep getting emails and texts from people saying, you kept me up. I couldn't go to sleep. I had to finish. Or I can't wait to get home to finish reading the book. Or you made me cry on the train. So I'm gratified.
Yeah,
that's
well,
a great response.
And you should be gratified that you wrote it and it's good. And that's a big thing to do in your life, to write a big novel, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Yeah. So the story, and we'll get into the details of the novel in a moment, but these figures, Ellen, are so disturbing. Almost one quarter of women will face the threat or experience rape during their college years. This is still, the book goes to the 1970s, the late 70s, but here we are in 2015, and it's still a very large issue.
You know, last night I'm doing a book tour, and I was in Washington, D.C. at Busboys and Poets, and a woman who's one of the co-founders of a group called Know Your Nine for Title Nine spoke briefly after my talk, and she described she had been at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and was raped on a date and reported it. This is just a couple of years ago, and they said to her, why don't you take off some time, get a job, you know, at Starbucks or something, until he graduates, and then it will be okay, you know, then you can come back. And she did. She left school, and, you know, this happened. Liddy, later a therapist, helps her see that she was banished. This young woman was banished from her school. And fortunately met someone who said, you have rights. There's a law, Title IX, that says that universities have a responsibility to make sure that gender discrimination does not interfere with your education, and rape absolutely interferes with your ability to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And so she went back to school. She used her rights under Title IX and helped start this organization. But this is unfortunately all too common.
Yeah. And when Liddy, at the urging of Deborah, goes to authorities, as they may be, at the university at the fictitious Danforth, and she's got bruises and there are pictures of how badly she's been wounded during this attack on her, she is taking on, and I'm wondering how much this is still the case, Ellen, a powerful, very wealthy family, stud on the campus, very well-known athlete. He's got the power. She has nothing. She has no power whatsoever, and she has to take on these forces that she thinks are larger than she is. Is that still the case? Is it still hard to take on the wealthy, the powerful, the football players, et cetera?
Right. It completely depends. There are some schools that are doing a much better job, and we know what it needs. We know what the answers are, but very few schools are doing it, and very few are doing all the steps that are needed. So, for example, in Liddy's case, Liddy didn't want to come forward because she said, "I'm a nobody going against a somebody," and that line literally comes from someone I talked to when I was at 9 to 5. In that case, she was being sexually harassed. And that was something that was told to her by the guy that was harassing her. He said, "You're a nobody going against somebody. Who's going to believe? Who are they going to believe?" And I dedicated my book to all the nobodies who are going against somebodies and changing the world for everybody. So that's the good news, that, you know, people are organizing. And the good news is that some campuses are responding. But unfortunately, there are lots of places. So John Krakauer just wrote a bestseller called Missoula about this problem in a college town in Montana where, like many college town, athletes rule. And this was, you know, cases that have been brought against football players. The people supposed to be in charge of intake and investigation often have no special training, make assumptions like, "Hey, he's an athlete. He could get any woman he wanted. Mm-hmm. Why would he resort to rape?" Same kind of thing that people said about Bill Cosby. Someone so rich and powerful, come on, women are throwing themselves at him. If you start with that kind of assumption, how on earth can you be impartial in hearing a
exactly
case like this? Yeah.
And so much of the Bill Cosby response that I shouldn't read it online, but you can't help yourself. You read some of the responses. Oh, these women are just in it for the money. They just want money from him. I'm thinking.
And what they don't realize, of course, is that there is no money. That's way past the statute of limitations. There's nothing that these women can gain. And many of them were silenced and made to regret having come forward years ago. And it's only the power of numbers that finally, I help persuade a lot of them to say, "I'm not alone. I always knew I wasn't the only one that this could have happened to.
Right.
Now I can see it and do something about it, at least to clear my own, for my own sake, the injury that I suffered, to be able to affirm that was not my fault. Something was done to me. It was wrong. It's cost me a lot. And I'm going to say it."
Yeah. I'm wondering if this was just part of the novel, Ellen, or if you have statistics on this. Liddy, when you, and I think that's a memorable line, feeling that she was a nobody going after somebody who was a somebody. This idea that, and Quincy was a member of a fraternity, where there seemed to be this idea that you should go after girls who they considered nobodies, and perhaps the girls consider themselves nobodies as well, because they would be easier prey.
You know, there were two things that inspired me to write this novel. One was that I had a friend who got a call from an obnoxious investigative reporter who found out that she had a friend who'd been assaulted in college many years earlier by someone who was now running for office.
Oh, really?
And wanted my friend to be the person to expose the story. And, you know, in her case, there was just one consideration. What does my friend want? And the woman said, "I can't live through that again," and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
But when she told me the story, I immediately thought, oh, my gosh, what if it were a lot more complicated? What if your job wasn't an educator, as my friend was, but you were the head of an organization that fought sexual assault? This was your job to expose it.
Right.
And what if the guy was a moderate Republican who was pro-choice and good on other women's issues, and the feminist groups were lining up to support him and were pushing you to do the same?
Mm-hmm.
And what if your husband, who's a great guy and a great dad, was a political consultant whose career had hit a bump and had just been given this great gig of the Senate campaign of the guy who was running against,
right,
who was a bad on women's issues and bad on the war in Iraq? You know, then what would you do? And also, if you felt responsible for the harm that came to your friend because you were the one who convinced her to come forward, and in fact, that process re-injured her, and
mm-hmm.
you felt responsible, what would you do then? So that was really what propelled. But the other thing that propelled me to write this book was a video I saw 8 or 9 years ago that Krakauer talks about in his book, too. It was the most terrifying thing I've ever seen. It's a reenactment. It's an actor, but word for word reenacting an interview with one of hundreds of young men who were in this study, all volunteers, none of them brought up on charges, none of them disciplined. The question they were asked by researchers, they were college students, was not, the word rape was never used, but the questions had to do with, did you ever have sex with someone without their consent, and did you ever use any physical recourse to make that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And all of them that answered yes, they asked them if they would do interviews. And so this guy was just reenacting what he did. And again, the questioner was completely objective and never used any word implying rape. But he said, so how would you pick? It was kind of, the guy was describing what to him was scoring. Mm-hmm. You know, like, just mm-hmm. like this elite prep school case where the guys use words like slay and score to get have sex with 15-year-old girls. These were seniors, and mm-hmm. it was a similar thing. You pick a girl who looks naive, usually a first-year student, and usually in the first months, who looks naive and who looks like she'd be flattered to be invited to a frat party. And then you make a punch that uses every kind of alcohol, so it's really potent, but you put in a lot of fruit punch so that the alcohol taste is masked.
Mm-hmm.
You get her to drink it really fast. You just keep filling her cup. And then you dance, you kiss, you make sure lots of people see you, and then you maneuver her up to her room. And so the questioner would ask things like, okay, and then what, you know, just like that kind of tone, and then what would you do? And so the point would be that you try to get her clothes off as fast as you could, and the questioner would say, and what if she resisted? Well, that's the point. You do it really fast, and you immobilize her. And if you had to, and he used a description without using the word, of a stranglehold where you put your arm over the person's windpipe so they literally can't breathe, which is what happens in the case with Liddy.
Yeah.
And I just was shocked by this because the guy had no remorse at all. It wasn't like he was looking back on those years and saying, what were we thinking? How could we have done it? He was bragging, and you thought, this is a technique that got taught that other people, you know, learned how to use. And then people say, oh, come on, that was a while ago. Well, guess what? Old Dominion, this year we all saw the pictures hanging out banners, this fraternity house, saying, hey, drop your freshman daughter out with us. We'll take care of her.
Yes. Right.
As if it's a joke.
Right.
As if it's a joke.
And the consequences for Liddy and for other women are so severe and so long-lasting. She winds up in an institution. She has to leave school. She is hurting. She can't do her exams. And, I mean, it's just awful. And it really governs the course of her life until we get some real strength from not only Liddy, but other women. I don't want to give too much away, but there are other women who come forward, and we get a sense of victory finally. But for so many years, she's in pain.
One of the things that I love about Liddy, and, you know, the process of writing fiction that's so great is characters just come to you and they tell you off. They say, what do you mean? I wouldn't say that. Get rid of that speech. This is what I'd say. And so they kind of tell you what they do. And Liddy is a really, even though she had all this happen to her, she's really smart and really courageous and really strong. And it's one of the other things I wanted to show about survivors, that it's not that they become a, just a mess and you can't function. And there were lots of things she was able to do. There were plenty of restrictions. And one of the characters in the book that I like a lot, Deborah's husband, this is a flaw. He doesn't understand. Why isn't she over it already,
right?
He says. He doesn't understand the nature of the injury. He's horrified by rape. He has a daughter. He can't bear to think of something like this happening to her. But there is this part of him that doesn't understand the depth of the harm.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it's an acquaintance, you trusted, you were flattered, and then there's so much self-blame. How could I have been so stupid? Why did I let him come back to my room? Why did I fall for the line? In this case, he uses that they both love the poet Rilke, and he's coming to borrow a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is exactly what society does. You beg for it, you ask for it, or you were stupid enough not to keep it from happening.
So in the book, and I'm wondering in real life what happens with this, when the men, when Quincy in particular is confronted with, what about your daughter? What are you going to tell her about date rape when she goes to college? And it affects other characters who were frat brothers of his. Is that a wake-up so that the rapist begins to confront the damage that he's caused and the crime he's committed, or is there still, denial going on?
Well, I think there's, what we've learned, those of us who are organizers learn early on, not everybody is salvageable. And so what the goal is to win over the many, many people who aren't there yet, but who are able to see it if they could just have some conversation, energize and enlist the smaller number, but nevertheless real cadre of men in this case, who can help lead this fight and isolate the jerks who maybe won't get it, but just make it impossible for them to get away with it. So we'd like to think there are some people, it's always a minority who are the perpetrators, and they are usually serial offenders. Some of them, I've met people who said, oh my God, I did something like this. I didn't realize that this is what it was. And they're very remorseful, and they are able to change, and that's what they want to do. I don't mean to say that there is no one like that. And the same thing, I think, with men who batter. There are certainly programs that help them learn how to deal with, not knowing how to handle anger and jealousy and all those things. But there are also, if we can get to the point where we don't allow the sexist culture that depicts women as objects and masculinity as all about scoring, and where we, this is a gift for men as well as women, to change that notion that this is what makes you a man, it will be a much better society when we get there for all of us.
Right. And considering so many years have gone by now, Ellen, since the late 70s, why are the figures still that more than half of women who are the victims of the threat of or the actual experience of rape quiet about it?
Well, the problem is that not only is rape culture still really prevalent, but the too many universities, now I'm just speaking about that, although obviously this problem exists in society overall, not just on campus. Too many universities are concerned, number one, with what will our image look like? What will the alumni think if this gets out? What about new students? Will they want to come here? And so they're more concerned with their image than they are with the problem and making it, addressing it. And so you get quick fixes. I mean, the Milwaukee Journal Monday had an article that many colleges are dealing with the requirement that they train students on the issue of sexual assault with online resources. And I just talked to someone yesterday at a college I'm going to speak at in Los Angeles. She said they have one of those videos, one of those online resources. And what it is a series of 10 videos. You look at it, and then you comment. There's no right or wrong answer. There's no test at the end. There's no evaluation. And there's no interaction with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can say, I did it, and you're done. And the college counts it that you are trained. And she said a lot of students, when the videos play, they just do something else. And then when the 2 minutes are up, they come, they write some comment, and they go on to the next one. It was shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this is, unfortunately, too common. So there's this group, Know Your Nine, and other groups. What they're doing is really pressuring administrations to have a program where they, first of all, focus on prevention and stop thinking of prevention as ways to teach girls how not to get raped, as many colleges would put it, and instead address the issue of rape culture, do exactly what I was describing of getting men to see this as something they can take on. I mean, there was a lovely young man at a book talk I did in New York last week. He said, I want to be that guy. There was I was on a panel, and one of the panelists was a man named Ted Bunch from a group called A Call to Men. And their approach is most men are not violent, but most men are silent. And we need to change that. We need to get men to speak up about this. We also need them to address what have they been taught about masculinity and how might they need to rejigger that view. And so this guy said, I want to be that guy, but it's, you know, I'm all by myself out here, and it's not going to be easy. And we said to him, that's the thing that needs to change. If the campus, rather than you, felt responsible for making these conversations happen, you would quickly find out that you're not by yourself. You would get that support, and that's what would help you, you know, be able to handle whatever grief you might get from some handful of people who would do that.
Ellen Bravo is our guest this hour. Her new novel is Again and Again, and we're welcoming phone calls for Ellen. Ellen is very well known on the national level and, of course, in Milwaukee, too, where she founded the 9 to 5 here in Milwaukee. She has written this book that's really, it's a good read and it's an important read, and it takes on a date rape at a fictitious college in the late 70s. Fast forward to 2010, and the story centers on the roommate of the young woman at Danforth who was raped, and the roommate saw the rape take place. She's now the head of an organization that is working on issues like violence against women and political issues as well, because she's in D.C. and meeting with Vice President Biden and, you know, on issues of violence against women. But it turns out that a U.S. Senate candidate who's a moderate Republican, good on some women's issues, is discovered to have been a rapist. And we won't let you know who initially tipped off a newspaper reporter, but that's an interesting story as well. And the young woman who was the roommate, Deborah, knows the story because she was the one who witnessed the rape. So it deals with all of those issues. Welcoming phone calls for Ellen. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Ellen directs the Family Values at Work Consortium, and they are a network of 21 states now dealing with paid sick days, family leave insurance. She's done lots and lots of work on work-family issues with 9 to 5 as well. So we'll be with you in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ellen Bravo, author of Again and Again, a novel, is our guest this hour, and we have a full bank of phones going, so just keep the number in your head. 800-486-8655. Ann in Platteville is our first caller. Ellen, hi, Ann.
Hello. Hi. I'd like to thank Ellen for the work that she's done, and I'd like her comments. I'm a rape survivor of a long time ago, and I'm appalled to hear what they're talking about, what you just were mentioning, and for rape prevention or sexual assault awareness on campuses. But what I did when my nephews, and we had a family of all nephews except for one, when they were old enough and I asked their parents if I could talk to them about my rape, and so I did. I talked to my nephews and my son about the rape. I didn't go into chapter and verse. I didn't think they needed that. But I talked to them about what they could do. And it was just what you were talking about at the end, which is don't stay silent. If you see somebody who is in a precarious situation, or she's drunk, or walking alone, offer to help get her out of the situation. Ask if she needs any help. Do whatever you can to help her. Just don't leave the situation.
And how did your nephews take this talk?
Well, I can't tell you I did any follow-up to ask if they've ever intervened, because I didn't. But they were all very quiet. They were they felt bad for me, which was nice in the sense that they were empathetic and they knew that they were not much younger than when I experienced the rape. And I think that that made a difference to them, that I was willing to talk to them about
right. It
very, very honestly and pretty openly.
Mm-hmm. Ellen?
I'm sure that it did, and I thank you so much for doing that and really appreciate you sharing that story. I wrote an open letter to young men entering college that the Milwaukee Journal printed. If you go to my website, ellenbravo.com, or my Facebook page, Ellen Bravo Author, you can find a link to it. And I did exactly the same thing. I'm talking about to the majority of young men who themselves would never engage in this behavior, what they could do. And here are some of the other things that I said, that they can help see what is their campus doing, like that young man who wanted to have these conversations, to go and say, why aren't you talking to men? Why are you giving us an online thing where we each in our rooms look at this? Why aren't you encouraging conversation? And why aren't you putting an emphasis on what kind of behavior we do? And what, and getting us to think about, well, what does rape culture mean? That sounds pretty awful. Surely I don't do anything like that. And then have people think about the music they listen to, the song, the movies they see, the TV shows, the ads, and just common expressions like scoring or slaying for sex. And then I also encourage them to think about, digging deep in their own thinking about those things. But the other thing I said to them, it's similar to what you said, is there may very well be among their acquaintances somebody who has already experienced this, because a lot of this happens in high school as well, and that the likely that person has been told it was her fault, that she wanted it, that she made it happen, and just affirming for her that they believe her and that they think it was horrible and that they're her friend, that's a huge step, as well as kind of doing the intervention that you described. If they see inappropriate behavior, anybody trying to put something into someone's drink or making the kind of punch that I was describing, et cetera. Right. And I met this woman, her name is Salamisha Tillett. She's a survivor, and she and her sister helped start a group called A Long Walk Home that's based in Chicago, but it's a national group that uses the arts to fight violence against, to try to stop violence against women and girls and to help people heal. And one of the things that she said is how the first person you tell reacts is huge in the healing process. So women and men learning how to be that good support for somebody who goes through this is really important. And I'm sure that your nephew's lives were changed by you sharing that. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann, very much for the call. All right, let's add an element of politics and how important what presidential candidates may say about women. Diana sends this email from Madison. It was not that many years ago that rape of a woman by her husband was legal. The front runner among Republican presidential candidates has made repeated derogatory comments about women, which are minimized by his supporters. College and university safety statistics are marketing tools.
Yes. She's talking about name names. She's talking about Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And not only has he made, pretty obnoxious comments about women, it's hard to make a comment about believing or look at that face and not have people interpret it to mean exactly what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
But this is also a guy, let us remember, who was accused of rape by his ex-wife. And it appears she walked back that story after, some time and some things happened. There is, unfortunately, as the person who sent you that email pointed out, a long history in our country where marital rape was not considered a problem at all. And that word wouldn't have been used. And the last state that outlawed marital rape was in 1993.
Oh, my goodness.
But in 2015, we have a state legislator in Utah, Brian Green, who said there was a bill being introduced about what's commonly known as yes means yes, requiring affirmative consent for sex to be okay? And he said, well, sure, if it's a stranger, but hey, if it's your wife, I mean, come on. So this is not a view. There are people in their country today who would say a man has his rights, a king of the castle, you know, that whole thing. So I think it would be very good to for people to continue to raise these concerns, and I think that eventually it will help discredit.
And what about, you brought this up a little bit earlier, Ellen, but what about safety statistics being marketing tools, so nobody wanting to be very forthcoming at that level about what's going on in terms of the number of sexual assaults on campus?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem that I was referring to earlier. I agree with you. It's a marketing problem, and instead, what we need to change is for universities to see, and their alumni and their future students to see, we're a school that takes this seriously, and here's what we do. We do an anonymous survey every year of our students. We find out if any of them have had non-consensual sex, and why did they report it, and if not, why not, and what are the barriers, and what can we do better? And we're committed to making those changes, and here's the steps that we've taken. I think there are a lot of parents who'd say, boy, I'd much rather send my kid to a school like that than a school that pretends that there is no problem.
John in Watertown is next. Hello, John.
Hi. I've been listening now for the last several years about the increased attention to date rape on college campuses and so on. And yet I don't hear the emphasis also on all the girls who don't go to college. What about them? It seems to me that when we deal with just colleges and post-secondary education, that we are really, it's class-based, and we're ignoring the lower class. And I can't help but feel that it's kind of... it's loaded towards the upper class who go to college.
I really appreciate what you're saying, and I mentioned that earlier, that many rapes happen not on campus and or in high school and or in technical schools, and that it's a problem that we need to address throughout society, not just on college campuses. So I couldn't agree with you more. I also think we need to say it's not just females who are raped. There are also males who are raped, but there are a lot of gay and trans people who are raped. You know, rape is a weapon. It's a weapon of war and of demeaning. It's a way of saying, how dare you step out of the norm that we have established for you. And there's a very high rate of rape of trans, you know, women or men. So it's something that we really have to recognize as a societal problem at every level. I appreciate your call. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. It was a good point. What about this whole issue, Ellen, of where we learn how you treat other human beings? There's a part of me that thinks, how can people not know that choking off the air that somebody needs to breathe to have a sex crime against them is not the way you treat human beings? I mean, we're way off here in how we deal with each other.
Right, but, you know, you can convince yourself that all you're doing is getting your due. Come on, what did she think was going to happen after kissing and dancing like that all night? She wanted it. So you can convince yourself that that's what's happening and that you're just moving it along. Like I said, the thing that was so terrifying about the interview tape that I heard was that the person didn't use any language that would imply that they thought their behavior was against social norms. And, you know, the same thing about when you have a guy running for president of the United States, I'm talking about Chris Christie here, who used the phrase, the teachers union should be punched in the face. And there's a lot of people who use expressions like slap in the face or punch, I could punch him out, just to express displeasure. They don't realize how much that is allowing a norm of violence. So I think that's how you do it. You just you know, get over it. And while we're talking about violence, let me just add something here. Because as a white woman talking about this subject, I want to say that there is a responsibility on us to point out that the white supremacist in Charleston who massacred 9 women and men in the name of protecting black men and women, in the name of protecting white womanhood from rape.
Right.
It's so vile, and it's
right.
There's a long history in our country of lynching of black men in the name of protecting white women. And, of course, it was never about protecting white women. It was always about creating violence and havoc for black families. The day that that young guy with a high-priced lawyer got acquitted of felony rape, the prep school kid I'm talking about,
right.
The 19-year-old, for assaulting a 15-year-old girl, was this anniversary, the 60th anniversary of the lynching of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old boy, for whistling at a white woman. So that's a history, a shameful history in our country that those of us who are white really need to address as we talk about this subject, too.
Margie in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, thank you for this topic. And I want to point out something personally, that when my daughter told me in 93, I believe, that she wanted to go to Marquette University, I was horrified, because it was just 2 years before that that Jeffrey Dahmer had made all the news. And I thought that would be the last place I would want to send my daughter. But she was firm, and I said I'd go with an open mind. And I went to the meetings and the presentations on campus, and they convinced me that they were doing everything they could to protect our children on campus. And I asked a lot of pointed questions. I got good answers, and I did follow-up. And she went there for 4 years without issue. Another university I looked at, one of my other children had a learning disability or a slow reader. And I looked into universities that would have a good learning lab that they could go to for help if they needed it. My kids are all grown, but when my grandkids are ready for university, if they go, it's going to matter to me if a university has owned the problem. They certainly own their football team and get a lot of prestige out of that. Why can't they own the issue that we will protect your girls?
I so appreciate you calling. And, you know, one of the things that we need to do, among others, is have parents of prospective students demand of universities, we want to see the record. We want to see what you've done on prevention. We want to see the number of surveys you've done, what the answers were, and how you addressed it. And if you didn't do that kind of survey, if you aren't doing prevention programs, if the only thing you're doing is online resources, nothing interactive, I'm not sending my kid there. I want to know how you're training your intake and investigation staff. I want to know what remedies you have to help people who have been raped to heal, and so on and so on. We need to demand that. And the more they get that kind of pressure, including from alums and donors, the more we'll see that change. But it's also happening because of the organizing that's being done by groups like Know Your Nine and Long Walk Home. So I hope that you'll look up groups like that and support them, because they operate on a shoestring and they really could use the help.
Ellen, I want to ask you, in the book, in your book, again and again, the perpetrator who's running for the U.S. Senate is confronted by several of his victims in a pretty dramatic fashion that causes him to change course, maybe not change heart, but change course. You mentioned Chris Christie. You mentioned Donald Trump. What is the responsibility of the national press or the press, and in what way should these kinds of people be confronted about the comments that they're making that contribute to a violent kind of culture?
Well, you know, although I don't agree with Megyn Kelly on most political issues, I thought her question of Donald Trump, is it presidential to use the kind of language you've used about women to say that they're fat pigs or slobs? I think that's a good question to ask. Is it presidential to say you're going to punch someone in the face because you disagree with them? Is it presidential, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And that's one kind of question. The second kind of question would be to say, we have statistics, whether, you know, whatever the number, it's far too high. I think we can all agree it's far too high in our country. What do you think causes that problem? And if you were president, what would you do to address it? And what do you think of what President Obama has done? Because what President Obama has done includes a culture approach, making this video called It's On Us, getting lots of prominent people to say we need to step up and play a role and you can too, investigating through the Department of Civil Rights, colleges, and saying you're under investigation. We want to make sure that you're not misusing Title IX funds and violating it by not dealing with this problem. And, you know, just generally raising awareness. You know, do they agree that that's been a good thing? Should they be doing more? Should they be doing less? That would be great. Let's get them on the record. Let's get them to take a position. That would be helpful.
Ellen Bravo, our guest this hour, her novel, Again and Again. Ellen is director of the Family Values at Work Consortium, and we're welcoming phone calls. The issue that she takes up, among others, but the central part of the book is a date rape on a college campus, and goes from the late 1970s, next chapter is 2010, and involves somebody running for the U.S. Senate and a woman who's in charge of an organization that's taking on violence against women in an incident that took place on campus concerning the senator and this woman's roommate. And it's a good read and an important topic. So we're welcoming phone calls for her. Here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we like to read your messages, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ellen Bravo is our guest now. Rebecca sends this email. Ellen, has anyone studied the effect of co-ed dorms on this issue? Years ago, most colleges had segregated gender housing. Is there a possibility that young males may feel that they have free access to women's housing? Don't these dorm situations put more women at risk?
It's a good question, and my researched answer is that what I had read indicated the opposite, that having co-ed dorms actually promotes more friendship and not this kind of inappropriate sexual conduct. But I'm not familiar with, you know, research on it, and it's a good question to ask. I suspect that it's the opposite. Certainly, anecdotally, that's my experience, that people I know who've lived in co-ed housing feel that it desexualizes the relationship, you know, makes people be more like pals. But I don't know for a fact. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think it's one of the things, you know, folks, it's an appropriate question to ask.
Mm-hmm. You talked about how important it was to have the first person you tell about this listen to what you say and be sympathetic. The friendship and the long-time friendship between Lydia and Deborah is an important one. It's unusual in that Deborah watched the attack taking place. When you go back to the way she handled it, did she do the right thing? She was sensitive to Lydia's concern about going public, and Lydia was devastated. But was it handled the right way in terms of their friendship, in terms of what was best?
So it's interesting. You know, one of the things I wanted to deal with in this book, Deborah walks in on this assault, and she has been at her college, has helped start a group against sexual assault. And one of the problems is that the administration doesn't take it seriously because they haven't gotten any complaints. So she really wants Lydia to complain, and she believes that they have the goods. She was the witness, and she took these Polaroids of the bruises afterwards. Lydia wouldn't go to a clinic because she didn't want her parents to find out. She's a scholarship student. And she's, you know, feels at this real disadvantage. If you were listening earlier, I used the phrase she uses of feeling like a nobody going against a somebody. So Deborah uses the language of, I'll support any decision you make, Lydia. I'll be there for you no matter what. But clearly she does have a preference, and she's desperately seeking help by coins in a payphone in the very cold winter in upstate New York where she's at school, from a rape crisis counselor from Rochester, New York, who's come to give them advice on getting their group started and, you know, has spoken there. And there's a scene where she says to the counselor, you know, she's just about Liddy. Liddy, she's just collapsed. And the counselor says, she's been raped. Mm-hmm. And she keeps reminding her, you know, in real life, these things are a lot more complicated than they are when you're just thinking about it on paper. So she means to be a good friend. She wants to, but I think later she realizes that she, you know, wasn't listening about what Liddy really wanted and was pursuing an agenda that obviously what happened at the hearing and the disaster that it became, and Ms. Magazine excerpted that chapter if you go
oh,
to
did
my,
they?
Yes,
oh.
If you go to my website or my Facebook page, you can find a link for that chapter of the hearing. And it's a disaster, and clearly it's not Deborah's fault. There's a lot bigger forces at play that have to do with things your callers have raised about the role of donors and money, and universities more concerned with image than with proper investigation. But there are mistakes that she makes in that process that she has to come to grips with. And I appreciate that you said that this is a book about date rape and politics, but it's also a book about friendship and love and marriage and mm-hmm. parenting and regrets and second chances. And it's you know, there are many male characters in this book who are wonderful, and even Aaron with his complicated approach to this problem, given that he's running the Senate race against this guy and it really he needs him to lose, and so he wants the story out. You know, there are a lot of efforts to be to do the right thing, and there's no character in the book that doesn't make some mistakes or you know, have some ambivalence about decisions they make. And I meant that to be, you know, that we're all human, we all have flaws. I didn't
sure.
want any character that was
yeah.
not going through that.
Rich in Gurnee, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll make this real fast. I'm a retired high school science teacher, and I am very disturbed about what we're doing in our public education with respect to things that lead to this. In our biology classrooms, I'm a science teacher, they said our biology classrooms were teaching that the origin of life and the expression of the human genome is the result, basically, of survival of the fittest. And that means violence and the ability to reproduce. And so we're telling kids in our biology classrooms that you're nothing more than animals and the result of a long string of sexual encounters, and then we're asking them to act like ladies and gentlemen and be kind to one another, and those two different views just don't fit.
I never thought of my science class teaching me
well,
that. I don't know.
I have to respectfully disagree, because I think one of the things about evolution, the good thing about our society is that we have the means to get rid of violence. We're not in a, particularly in a country like the United States, we're not in a situation of scarcity. We're not in a situation where the only way we have to make something happen is to take it from somebody else. And if there's anything we've learned over time, that there were, you know, different patterns that developed, and there were societies where there was more collaboration and sharing, and those societies survived better. I think there are other lessons from evolution than lessons of violence, to be sure. And we know, you know, we know what it means to have that kind of peaceful collaboration. We certainly know what it means to say each of us has the right to determine our own, you know, what happens to our body, to say yes or no, to make decisions, that no one has the right to force us. I think those are things that can be and are taught in school. My husband was also a high school teacher, and he developed a wonderful program of talking to kids about relationships and what's voluntary and what isn't. Kids can get that. It's not hard to understand it. What's hard is to go against the culture that says don't snitch,
mm-hmm.
and how to make it possible for kids to speak up without being in that role of a snitch, how to create vehicles for kids to give support to each other where there are multiple people at once saying, hey, we don't act that way in our school. Lay off. Don't talk about mm-hmm. so-and-so in that way. And I'm not going along with this, but I also, I, not in defense of this poor girl who can't defend herself, but I, as another guy in this school, am saying this is not the culture we want for our school.
Yeah.
That's
Ellen,
what makes the difference.
Thank you ever so much for being with us. Thanks for writing the novel. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Take good care.
Ellen Bravo, the book is Again and Again, a novel. Ellen is director of the Family Values at Work. She's the founder of 9 to 5 and was executive director for many years. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, Scotty Myers for on-air production in downtown Milwaukee.